Welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback in news and in politics. Undivided is presented by our fabulous founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. And if you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, remember, we do a bonus episode just like this every single Wednesday on Patreon and Locals. That's patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. A few things to get to today. We're going to talk about inconvenient truths and how that fits into the role of the media. Also, there is a teacher strike happening in Kent, Washington that is keeping kids out of school. I'll give my thoughts on that. Plus, Vice President Kamala Harris becomes just the latest member of the Biden administration to completely ignore the question about who is paying for their big plan to cancel student debt. Does the messenger matter? As you know, I've been preaching about the fact that I think the state of Washington should hire back workers who were fired over the vaccine mandate. And now there is a high-profile Democrat who does a job similar to mine, who believes that ferry workers in particular should be hired back as well. So we'll get to all of that. But first, a follow-up to a story I discussed last week. We were talking about the primary election in Florida and the fact that Charlie Crist is going to move forward to face Ron DeSantis in the race for governor in November. Charlie Crist, he was a former governor of Florida, also a former attorney general, a member of Congress. He was a Republican, then was an independent, and now is a Democrat. So he is running right now as a Democrat. And last week on the show, I played a clip from Charlie Crist that I believe disqualifies him to serve in elected office. I don't believe he should be anywhere near public service. And it was in response to a question about what he would say to Florida voters who support Ron DeSantis and his policies.
Those who support the governor should stay with him and vote for him. And I don't want your vote. If you have that hate in your heart, keep it there. I want the vote of the people of Florida who care about our state. Good Democrats, good independents, good Republicans. Unify with this ticket.
Well, it turns out that Charlie Crist isn't the only one adopting that messaging. Governor Kathy Hochul in New York was at a campaign event, and she took things a step further as to how she feels about Republican voters in her state.
And we're here to say that the era of Trump and Zeldin and Molinaro, just jump on a bus and head down to Florida where you belong, okay? Get out of town. Get out of town. Because you don't represent our values. You are not New Yorkers.
And to me, Kathy Hochul saying that is even more egregious than Charlie Crist, because Kathy Hochul is the current governor of New York. So you have the current governor of New York who is essentially telling part of her constituents that not only does she not like him and care about him, she doesn't even want them to live in her state. I mean, can you imagine the message that sends? You know, in Washington state, for instance, I think there are Republicans who believe that Governor Inslee doesn't care about them, who believe that Governor Inslee doesn't particularly like them. But imagine Governor Inslee coming out and saying explicitly, Republican voters, I don't even want you to live in my state. Just imagine that for a second and imagine how that would make you feel. Now, you might say, well, what's the difference between thinking it and actually saying it? I would argue that there is a difference. Because to me, it almost verges on the point of mental instability. That you, as the governor of a state, tasked with dealing with people's needs, with people's emergencies, with people's crises, care so much about their political affiliation as opposed to the human being, that you would rather they just don't even live in your state at all. And you're willing to say that out loud. To me, it's a disqualifier. And I can't even imagine that, you know, Democratic voters in New York State, why would you want your governor to say that? Imagine if the roles were reversed, you had a Republican governor who said, I don't even want you to live in the state. I mean, this is not the direction we need to be heading as a country when we talk about bridging political divides. And, you know, Joe Biden, this messaging is coming from the very top. What did Joe Biden run on? He said that he would be a uniter, not a divider. That was his point of differentiation between himself and President Trump. He said that he would be a president for everyone, Yet he has taken aim at so-called MAGA Republicans and spoken about them with the same tone that Kathy Hochul and Charlie Crist are speaking about Republican voters.
What's happened is there are not many real Republicans anymore. I respect conservative Republicans. I don't respect these MAGA Republicans.
If you are truly trying and care about bringing the temperature down in this country, care about avoiding another January 6th as an example, why is that the messaging that you would take? And that's what I would ask them. How do you find that to be helpful? How do you find that to be in line with your responsibilities as an elected leader? What do you think that that will accomplish? You know, I did a live Q&A last night. We do one every single month for subscribers on Patreon and Locals. And someone asked me what it would take to get Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal out of office. If you're not familiar, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal represents the 7th Congressional District in Washington, which is basically the area around in and around Seattle. And she is a progressive. She's the chair of the House Progressive Caucus. She's one of the most high-profile progressive politicians in the entire country. And Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, I pulled up the primary results. She won the primary election back at the beginning of August with 85% of the vote. 85% of the vote. Now, do I like Congresswoman Jayapal's policies? No. She was very one of the lead drivers on the forgiveness of student debt, as an example. You know, I'm just not in line with her politically, and I'll be honest about that. I've always had a very cordial, friendly relationship with her. I've interviewed her many times. But going back to that question and how I tie this all into Charlie Crist and Kathy Hochul, what would it take to get Pramila Jayapal out of office? You know, my answer to that was essentially that it doesn't bother me that she's in office. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal represents the views of her constituents. 85% of the vote. She is a progressive. She represents a very progressive congressional district. It doesn't bother me for people to get the representation that best suits them. That's what elections are for. That's what voting is for. So I don't really care to get Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal out of office if that's who her voters want to represent them. Now, do I think that the Seattle area might be served better by some more moderate policies? Yes, I believe that, but clearly that's not what voters there believe. You know, I think we lose sight of the fact that divided government is really essential for progress. Divided government, when you are forced to contend with the fact that people have different ideas than you, divided government leads to the very best ideas. I don't believe that we would have a functioning government, a government that functions to its full potential, rather, if we had just Republicans across the board, or Democrats across the board, or progressives across the board. And you look at the Senate, you know, it oftentimes takes a little bit of compromise in the Senate to be able to get things done. And compromise at the end of the day leads to pieces of legislation that will serve a greater number of Americans. So when I hear Charlie Crist and Kathy Hochul say what they said, I hear two people who don't want their ideas challenged, who don't want their ideas questioned, who want to live in a safe little bubble and operate in a safe little bubble. And it doesn't lead to the best ideas when no one's challenging them. And similar to Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal in Seattle, you know, she's more progressive than even, you know, the Democrats who serve in other congressional districts in the state of Washington. In all of that diversity, the progressive in Seattle, the moderate Democrats in other parts of Western Washington, the Republicans in far eastern Washington, all of that diversity of political opinion, of thought, of ideology leads to a wider array of ideas, helps better serve different types of constituencies in different areas of our state. And ultimately, the differing opinions allow for disagreement that can lead to better ideas, if we let it. So what I'm trying to say is that it is an absolute necessity that we embrace people who have different opinions than our own, who have a different outlook on life, who have a different worldview than our own, because that's the only way that we can grow. That's the only way that we can find progress. And ultimately, in the case of Kathy Hochul and Charlie Crist, if he were to beat Ron DeSantis, which I highly doubt, that is the only way they can truly live up to their obligations in their positions, is to serve as many people in their states as they can in the best possible way that they can. And that will require them to work with people who don't share their worldview. I've said repeatedly on the show that I'm not in favor of the vaccine mandates that states like Washington put down. And we screamed from the rooftops about what the implications would be. And people just dismissed it as, oh, fear-mongering, right-wing, conservative, whatever, anti-vaccine, COVID denier. But it was so obvious and so common sense what was going to happen. The fact that when you fire firefighters, you fire police officers, nurses, doctors, ferry workers, Department of Transportation workers, you are going to have worker shortages. And those shortages were going to impact people in a really profound way. And what are we seeing? I mean, Harborview Medical Center had a time when it wouldn't even accept all the patients who were coming there in ambulances. The King County Jail had to stop accepting new bookings in the middle of the night. You had the mountain passes closed down for days on end last winter because you didn't have enough plow drivers to clear them. And you've had repeated delays at the ferry system in Washington State, which is a big deal. People don't just use the ferries to go out to the islands and sip rosé. There are people who use the ferries, rely on the ferries to commute. They're stranded without them. And so ferry delays are very serious, and they have been happening with increasing frequency. And, you have this real hesitancy from elected leaders and from folks in charge of these agencies to acknowledge the extent to which the ferry delays can be contributed to people fired over the vaccine mandate or who took early retirement as opposed to being fired. So, I've been, some of my other friends in the media, like Dory Monson and Jason Rantz, they have been just screaming from the rooftops about the fact that you have to bring these fired workers back. The CDC says, it's not even us, the CDC says that there's no need to treat vaccinated and unvaccinated people differently. And Governor Jay Inslee is no longer going to mandate boosters, which means that people who got the original vaccine a year ago are in the exact same position right now as someone who never got vaccinated if those people didn't get boosted. That's facts, that's science, that's what the CDC recommends. And so at this stage, there's really no reason not to offer these folks their job back. I mean, I'm assuming some of them will not take it because they feel very wronged by the state of Washington, but maybe a couple of them will, and that could make a big difference. So anyway, of course, the governors and his staff, they're just dismissing anyone who's even perceived as Republican who asks about this is just fear-mongering and politically motivated. And I saw this commentary from a friend of mine, Dave Ross, who is a host at Cairo News Radio, a Democrat, albeit, I think a moderate Democrat, but someone who has a very well-respected voice among Democratic politicians in our state. Certainly Governor Jay Inslee, Dave Ross, has been around in the Seattle area for years, for decades. And people really respect his opinion on things. And I was happy to see Dave put out a commentary saying that, and this is the headline of his commentary, failing to rehire unvaccinated WSF workers is more about saving face than lives. Because that sums up exactly how, I feel about this, what I've been saying about this, and to have Dave Ross, who's a well-respected voice among Democrats, say the exact same thing, I think is more effective. I think it is more meaningful in the eyes of, for instance, the governor and the people who are making these decisions. Sometimes the messenger really does matter. And so it helps to have a messenger who's on the same political side as the person who you're trying to get through to. I want to play for you. It's not very long. I want to play for you Dave Ross's commentary on this issue.
Every time I hear about a ferry trip being canceled due to a crew shortage, I feel sad. Because I know there are crew members who could still be working if only they'd gotten vaccinated 2 years ago. And I don't see why they just can't be rehired. Ferry riders aren't expecting a return to the old schedule. They know ridership is still way down. But to have to cancel runs, even on the reduced schedule, for lack of crew, tells me something's not working. Delays are part of the ferry lifestyle. That's why you keep a few books in the car. But lately, you need an encyclopedia. And while I appreciate the effort to recruit new employees for the future, you need something now. So my suggestion would be to send a bouquet of roses to each of the 121 Ferry System employees who were separated for lack of a COVID shot and attach a fancy card offering to rehire them. This might be awkward. Not all will accept. But even if it brings back only 10 or 20, it means fewer runs have to be canceled. I realize most Democrats won't like this idea because they know Republicans, of course, will say, "Told you so, the vaccine mandates went too far." But Democrats can simply remind them that they're the party that's been claiming you could cut state government by 30% and everything would be fine. Well, if ferry staff cuts are only 10% and things are clearly not fine. So you're even. The vaccine policy may have been necessary in 2020. But now, it looks like it's more about saving face than solving the problem.
I think that's very well said. And again, the general takeaway is there is no reason at this point not to offer those ferry workers their jobs back. Yes, you can try to hire the next generation of ferry workers, but they need to be caught up to speed. It's expensive for the state to do that. When you have somebody who's done the job, who's had the training, and you can just put them back into the job, do you have to admit that you were wrong? Yeah. Might there be legal implications for that? I guess. But I think there's something to be said about a leader who's willing to step back and say, look, I was wrong, or we were using the best available information that we had at the time. Things have changed. The CDC's guidance has changed. Therefore, we think it's appropriate to bring back these workers because it's the best thing for the state. It's the best thing for our workforce. It's the best thing to keep transportation moving or whatever it is, you know, in the case of police officers or firefighters. So I agree with Dave Ross, again, a Democrat, who says that this is more, not bringing these workers back is more about saving face than it is about saving lives. That at this stage is indisputable. And you really do have to ask yourself why the governor won't just go there, why he won't direct agencies to just go there. Is it fear of a lawsuit? Is it saving face? Or is it out of spite that you had workers who wouldn't abide by this mandate a year ago? I would really hate to think that it's out of spite, but I genuinely cannot rule that out. But if the governor, you know, heading into the winter seasons, if he wants to do the right thing, if he wants to avoid some of the shutdowns that we had last winter due to a lack of tow drivers or plow drivers, if he wants to deal with the public safety crisis in a meaningful way, the governor should stand at a podium and say, we're going to bring back all the fired firefighters, the fired police officers. We're going to give all of them an opportunity to get their job back. That would be the right thing to do. And you now have bipartisan, you have conservatives saying it, you have independents saying it, you have Democrats saying it in Dave Ross, that this is the right thing to do, and this is the only avenue that makes sense. Friday on the show, we talked about how the Biden administration comes out with this huge announcement, you know, forgiving student debt for some borrowers. And obviously, it's not something that he just woke up and said, let's do this, and they go out and announce it. Obviously, there was work that went into the exact details of the plan. And you would think that they had also done an analysis or a consideration for how much it would cost to forgive $10,000, in some instances $20,000 per borrower, money that's not coming back into the Treasury. And I was talking on the show on Friday about how I was just flabbergasted. I mean, I guess at this stage I wasn't surprised, but it still is really jarring that they send out, you know, they made this big announcement, and then they send out White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and Domestic Policy Advisor Susan Rice out to face the media completely incapable of answering what they should know is going to be the number one question that the media has. And that is about the cost and who's going to bear the burden of that cost. It's a no-brainer. I was very happy with how the White House press corps performed on this, trying to press both of those ladies into answering the obvious question.
They have to, we'll see what, when they take up the opportunity, we'll be able to give you a much better sense of that.
But are those numbers ballpark at this point?
I think it depends on the numbers. Like, you know, unfortunately, and we're here to encourage as many people to take it up as possible. If 43 million borrowers take it up, that'll be different than if 50% of those 43 million take it up.
If it is 43 million, if I could just follow on, you know, if the full number of eligible borrowers do take advantage of the program, what would the cost be?
I can't give you that off the top of my head.
So I don't know what's worse, if they really don't know or if they're pretending not to know because they don't want to say it because it isn't as sparkly and cool if you have to actually talk about the implications and the ramifications of it. And I just today wanted to add another name to the list of people in the Biden administration who simply refuse to talk about the cost of this, and that is Vice President Kamala Harris. Fox News confronted her as she was on her way to an event with the very same question.
Who specifically is footing the bill for student loan forgiveness? We haven't gotten a concrete answer from the administration yet.
Well, let's start with this. First of all, a lot of the same people who are criticizing what we rightly did in following through on a commitment that we made to forgive student loan debt are the same people who voted for a tax cut for the richest Americans. So when we look at who is benefiting from this, 90% of the people who are going to benefit from student loan forgiveness make under $75,000 a year. And that debt has been the reason that they're unable to start a family, buy a home, and pursue their piece of the American dream.
So not only in that case does Kamala Harris not answer the question, but you see how she gaslights. You see how she turns it on the other side. Well, what about how Republicans felt about bailing out businesses and all this? And that's a common retort that we've heard. Well, what about businesses who got PPP loans? What about, you know, the bailout of Wall Street? I don't agree with the bailout of Wall Street. And in some instances, I don't agree with the forgiveness of PPP loans. I think there are some, and I've talked about this on the show last week, there are some PPP loans where if you have businesses that were shut down by the government, hell yeah, the government needs to do something to help those businesses continue to be able to pay their employees. But I think there were some businesses that got PPP loans that would have just been just fine without them because they were able to operate in some way. And so, you know, it's like this or that. Either, you know, well, we're going to do this terrible fiscal, we're going to make this terrible fiscal decision, but yeah, but the other guys made a terrible fiscal decision 3 years ago. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd. And I think it speaks to some level of incompetence that the White House would not be prepared to have good, solid messaging on the cost. And I said, again, I've said that I would feel better if they came out and just said, listen, yeah, this is going to cost taxpayers in the U.S. a bit of money, but we believe that it's the right thing to do. This is the route that we're taking. This is a decision that we've made. I think if you can just own, if you believe in what you're doing, if you believe in the decision you're making as an elected leader, own it. Just own it. You're already in office. You have the job. If you want to, you know, write off $10,000, $20,000 in debt for students so they can get out from these crushing loans and continue on with their lives, own it. I would have much more respect for the Biden administration if they owned the decision, owned the consequences of the decision when it comes to the economy, and just move forward from there and said, no, we're not going to apologize for it. We think it's the right thing to do. I would think a lot more of them than I do now, considering that they are trying to gaslight Americans into believing that the price of this doesn't really matter or that the price of this isn't going to impact other people. In Kent, Washington, students have been out of school for the past 3 days because teachers are on strike. I should note that it's not legally protected for teachers in Washington State to go on strike. And so there's a question certainly about what the Kent School District is going to do to try to force them back in the classroom. They can ask a judge to seek an injunction. You know, this is disappointing on a number of fronts. Kids have had a really tough time during the pandemic, being out of classrooms and now to be excited and get ready to go back to school. And then to have this strike all of a sudden happen is a little bit absurd. And, you know, the teachers know that they have a lot of leverage here. You know, this is a politically friendly state when it comes to teachers' unions. And so they're not going to see, you know, the governor or the attorney general try to go after them for picketing, even though, again, they're not legally protected to do so. And so they know they have a ton of leverage to get higher pay, for example, by striking and keeping kids out of school. And it's hard to see kids used in this way. I know that the teachers union will say, well, this is about getting a better education for the students. I don't disagree that some of the things they're asking for, like more counselors, might be helpful to students. But, you know, you always want to see them be able to negotiate these things while the kids are still in the classrooms, as opposed to having the kids out of class. But I spoke today with Layla Jones, who is with the Kent Education Association, and we talked through some of the criticisms that folks have about a teacher's strike happening at this juncture. Obviously, a question on a lot of people's minds is how come this couldn't get worked out before kids were supposed to go back to school?
Yeah, obviously, you know, no one wants to be here, right? Our teachers would much rather be in classrooms with students. But we started bargaining late in July. And so the Kent Education Association's bargaining team, which is made up of teachers and educators from throughout our district, were ready to go in May, at the very beginning of May. And at that point, we asked for the district to get some dates on the calendar, and we didn't. And so we asked again in June and still didn't. And our first bargain meeting didn't occur until July 12th. So we are operating on a hyper-condensed timeline when normally we would have started bargaining in a normal year, maybe with a different bargaining team, we would have started back in May.
And did they give you a reason for not wanting to start earlier?
They did not.
What are the key sticking points at this juncture, Layla?
So for our membership, which Kent Education Association covers, our certified educators, so our classroom teachers, our counselors, our special ed nurses are with us as well. So we have our member priorities are really student-centered. We want to make sure that our caseloads and class sizes are manageable, and that especially our caseloads for like our special ed programs, that those are manageable and sustainable. So we don't want to have teachers burning out or overworked. We also want and understand the need for more wraparound services like those counselors and those psychologists. And not all of our school buildings have counselors or even nurses. So we know that our buildings need that additional support. And we are looking for a cost of living increase to keep up with, you know, the rising cost of everything, housing, your food that you buy at the grocery store, all those sorts of things. We need to be able to keep up with inflation. So that is an ask as well. We're worried about being able to retain the teachers that we have in our district. And we don't want to lose them to neighboring districts. And we're also worried about recruiting the next generation of educators. And when a district is has really unmanageable and unsustainable workloads and they're not paying as well as the next district over, that makes it incredibly difficult to keep and get new staff.
One of the things that's been brought up, we have a lot of schools, public schools in the state and districts who have actually lost students, and Kent is one of them. They've had a decrease in, since 2020, 673 elementary school students, 297 middle school students, 69 high school students. High school actually is the only one that increased. So when you talk about kind of class sizes, aren't the class sizes getting smaller, or why aren't they if you're seeing a decrease in enrollment across the district?
Yeah, so what I will say is our class sizes, and I've been in Kent for, I can't remember if it's year eight or year nine, but I also grew up in Kent and graduated from our Kent schools. When I, for example, first started as a teacher in Kent, as a kindergarten teacher, I had 18 students. The last 3 years in my classroom, I've had 26. So our class sizes, they haven't necessarily changed, but the staffing has. So instead of staffing so there's wiggle room to have additional students, we're all staffed to our capacity. And when we're all working at capacity, that just means we have less time to provide the individualized support that each student needs. We have less time to check in with a family member about how things are going. We just have less time all around. We're all at capacity.
The other argument that has been brought up as well when it comes to teacher pay, and I think, you know, on the whole, people agree that teachers in many instances are underpaid for what they do. But, you know, there are a lot of teachers in the Kent District who make six figures and well over the median income of parents and households in the city of Kent. You know, you guys work three quarters of the year compared to some of, again, the parents of your students. So I guess when you're on the picket line keeping kids out of school to demand pay that's higher than a lot of the households of the kids that you teach, how do you think that comes off to those parents?
Yeah, I absolutely get that. And I think the flip side is the reason we do have our educators that are making that much is because they're experienced. You know, you get to those levels of salary when you've been in the district for 20 years. You get to those levels of salary when you have a master's degree or your doctorate. So while I do see that that is above the median, it's because we're qualified and quality educators. And what I would say to that is, isn't that who you want teaching children?
Well, there's some, and I've heard from some parents who, you know, are frustrated that you guys can't hash this out with the kids in school. As you know, the kids have been through a lot the last couple years, you know, in and out of classrooms, away from their friends. You know, you mentioned one of the things you guys are pushing for, you know, an increase in counselors. We know there are a lot of mental health issues with students. But just for the sake of the students, why not continue to teach while you continue to bargain with the district?
Well, there's a couple things to note there. First of all, we do want to be in our classroom with kids. Absolutely. I've been, you know, going and speaking with members out on the lines, and we would much rather be in our classroom with students. But the classrooms that we want to walk into whenever this is over, we want those classrooms to be better than the ones we left in June. And we believe that our students deserve better, and that our community deserves better, and that our colleagues deserve to have a manageable caseload. The other piece to that is this is not just unique to the Kent Education Association in Kent. Our other labor partners that work and make up the Kent School District as a whole are also having these same struggles with the district leadership.
As you know, Layla, there is no legally protected right for teachers to strike in Washington State. The district has alluded to what they did a few years ago, you know, having a court place an injunction and start to levy fines. If they go that route, how does that influence what you guys are doing?
Well, ultimately, we have to take that to the membership. So tonight, the school board is having a special meeting to have that exact conversation. I think our teachers and our community support this movement to make sure that we're getting resources into our classrooms that we don't have. And I will say that I do believe our educators are, I know we're dedicated. We are dedicated to this community, but I would also say we are determined to get a contract that reflects what we know to be the best environment, not only to work in as, or, you know, as a teacher, but also the best environments for our students to learn in.
And, you know, pay, you know, is traditionally obviously at the forefront of negotiations like this that result in a strike. But I've heard also, I think it was on KUOW, that some of the other things you guys are asking for include air conditioning in the buildings. Is that something that you guys would really continue to strike over? Or is that something that can be, that is just sort of tangential?
No, that's not something we're out here about. I mean, it's 90 degrees, you know, it'll be 90 degrees tomorrow. It was 90 degrees last week. I mean, you know, heat's not a fun thing to be working in, but that's not going to keep us from going in our classrooms. Some of our buildings in our district are very old, though, and the HVAC systems aren't adequate to cool appropriately. So when we do have hot days like this in August, it gets really, really hot in our classrooms, and that impacts the students as well. When it's just so hot, they're, you know, you walk into classrooms and the kids are like falling asleep because it's just so hot. So that is a concern, but that's not a reason why we're all out here right now.
Okay, so that's not one of the sticking points. I saw that from Lily Fowler with KNKX.
No, that is not a sticking point. I mean, we do have language in our contract that it. A classroom should be cooled and heated appropriately. So in the wintertime, we don't want to all be freezing and our students in coats, just like in the fall or you know, late summer, we don't want everyone, you know, to be sweating and just falling asleep, you know, lethargic. That's also not a good place to be learning.
No, I mean, I would love AC. AC isn't very common in the Pacific Northwest. So that's why I asked. I was like, is that really something that you guys are going to hold out over? Let's end with this because I know you're driving all over the district today. You know, the devil's advocate question is obvious. You, like I said, there is not a legal protection for you guys to strike. Kids have had a hell of a 2 years. They need to be in classrooms. And here we are, you know, keeping them out for a third day in a row from going back to school. So is it selfish for you guys to be out on the picket line?
And I can see that someone taking that being the takeaway. I can see that of like, oh, you know, the teachers are out there and the kids aren't learning. Whenever we do go back, first and foremost, the kids will have their full school year. It's going to start later, right? The other thing I will say to that is, having come out of this pandemic, like I alluded to my own personal class sizes, you know, years ago, I had the same amount of kids pre-pandemic as I did post-pandemic. The needs are so much greater now. So while it is inconvenient, and I acknowledge that this is an inconvenience and it puts extra burden on the community to find places for students to be during this time, what I will say is we are the ones in the classrooms, boots on the ground, that see what's going on with our kids. And that's why everyone that I talk to out here across our district, which is massive, that's what they're out here for. They know that our kids need more. And if we're not the ones to stand up and say it's time to do better, no one else is going to do that. The district hasn't done that. This last school year was so incredibly difficult. We've seen teachers leave in droves, and it's not unique to Kent. This is national. Teachers are just leaving the profession, and nobody's coming in. And it has been just exponentially harder after the pandemic. Students' needs are that much greater. And so what we're out here doing is making sure that when we do go back to those classrooms, we can do our best by the students that we serve.
And we have reached out to the Kent School District to try to get someone on to dispute some of the things that are said, to talk about, you know, sort of where they're at in the negotiation process. So we'll see what happens here. But again, you know, the only concern should be about kids and what's best for kids. And I think it's really hard to argue at this point that being in the classroom is best for kids. And so when you have teachers who say, we're doing this for the kids, we're keeping kids out of class for the kids, for the benefit of the kids, I personally think that that's a little bit disingenuous, and I hope that they can come to terms. I mean, I look at like police officers, for instance. You know, somebody was like, you sound very anti-union, and what about the police union? You know, you've never said anything bad about them. That's not true. But, you know, I've been critical of the police union in Seattle before. But also, if it would be a much different story for me if police were refusing to work. If you had police officers who were refusing to respond to 911 calls, would I be on the side of the police union then? Absolutely not, because you're holding public safety hostage. There's a reason why public workers in our state are not protected to strike. It's because it can have a disastrous impact on all sorts of sectors, like education, like public safety. So hopefully they can work something out soon. And again, we'll get the district on Wednesday if they're available to give their side of things. Last week on the subscriber-only episode, I had my friend Jason Rantz on to talk about a story that is now getting national attention. And that is, the University of Washington, UW-Madison, put out a study back in March claiming that rates of depression among transgender youth plummeted if they got gender-affirming care. There was, of course, an article put out by Jesse Singal on his Substack that totally disproved that entire thesis. There wasn't evidence in the study to show plummeting rates of depression. Even the study researchers ended up coming out in internal emails and saying, yeah, we didn't find any evidence that there was reduction in depression rates. And so, you know, you had this study that went out that had this, you know, really, I think, harmful narrative. If you're a parent who has a trans child and you're debating, do I get them gender affirming care? And then you see this press release from UW Medicine saying that if you get your child gender-affirming care, it can save their lives and prevent them from committing suicide. That's a very serious thing. And for UW to get it so wrong and to put out that full statement when the study didn't show anything of the sort is very concerning. And so I had Jason Rantz on because he talked about, he had done, once the news came out that this study wasn't what they claimed it was, Jason Rantz did a public disclosure request, got his hands on some internal emails from the University of Washington that showed they wanted to just bury this, that they said explicitly only conservative news outlets are asking about the error and we're not even going to respond to them because they have an agenda. I mean, the agenda was getting to the truth. But here's a part of my interview with Jason Rantz, in case you didn't catch it. What's some of the most interesting stuff you found in these email exchanges about pushback on the study?
I mean, they were really clear in these emails that they did not want to be proactive in correcting the record, even though they were responsible for the record being incorrect to begin with, because they were getting positive coverage. They say that explicitly. There is one instance, one email of a doctor who was part of the study. She was on the email chain, Kim Ahrens. And originally she had put together a statement to try to explain where the confusion was coming from. But then later on in the email chain, she said she would be comfortable not clarifying any of this at all if it means it would just bring more attention to the error. And it's like, you're a doctor. You're not supposed to hold that position. You should be a champion for making sure people get the data correct. So we're making smart decisions on how to treat patients. There are real lives attached to all the information out there, including the misinformation. And I also find it odd coming from UW, which has an entire program there that's about going after disinformation, except you've got it going on here and there doesn't seem to be any shame in any of it. They did not reach out to any of the media outlets that got it wrong. And they simply told me in a statement that, oh, well, the story wasn't really a story at that point. I'm sorry, it was a story because you got it wrong.
So after Jason Rantz's story came out, where he released all these emails from inside the University of Washington's communications team, Jesse Singal, who wrote the original takedown of the study that just demolished the core thesis of it, he put out on Twitter, he said, I've now read the full cache of emails Rantz obtained, and I cannot overemphasize how much cover was provided to UW by the fact that after my initial article, it was only conservative outlets that reached out about this scandal. And I can't agree more. And that was one of the things that I brought up with Jason. The fact that they would explicitly in one of these emails say, we're not going to proactively correct the record because it's only conservative outlets reaching out and they have an agenda. You're talking about a public university, a medical entity, a study that's supposed to be based on scientific data, and they're not going to correct it proactively, publicly, because it's only conservative outlets reaching out. And I told Jason, it troubled me that it was only conservative outlets reaching out, that you wouldn't have other news agencies who published the initial report as it was framed be angry by that, be angry by being misled, by in turn misleading their readers and their viewers, that they would reach out to UW and say, hey, why did you guys tell us that this study found something that it didn't? You would hope that every entity that published an article would do that. Jesse Singal went on to say, the comms team is explicit about this over and over in their internal emails. Because it's the College Fix and the Daily Caller reaching out, they see no need to engage or respond. Lib outlets had no interest in pursuing a story about a hospital distorting suicide research. So over the weekend, I was kind of hard on King 5 News in Seattle, because King 5 News is one of the outlets that put out the kind of initial findings without really questioning it, what Jason Rantz refers to as press release reporting. Like, they get the press release from UW. Oh, wow. This study found that it gender-affirming care plummeted rates of suicide among youth. Let's type up an article about it and not question it at all. And so the King 5 News, which is the NBC affiliate in Seattle, had an article that they put up in March, right after the study came out, saying gender-affirming care reduced depression in 60% of teens in University of Washington study. And then their article went on to talk about it from a political standpoint, how Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently issued a directive ordering the Department of Families and Protective Services to open child abuse investigations against parents who help their transgender children receive gender-affirming care. And so King 5 quotes a researcher saying gender-affirming care is life-saving care. So basically, King 5 is pushing the exact agenda that UW wants to push here. Well, as of over the weekend, King 5 News had not corrected this article. And they knew that it was incorrect. They knew it was inaccurate. I don't know if King 5 News saw the Jesse Singal article, but Jason Rantz reached out 8 days ago now to King 5 News, to their news director, and reached out to them on Twitter to say, hey, this article is inaccurate, and basically, are you going to correct it? Never heard back. I also know internally that there were individuals at King 5 News who had brought attention to this because of what they were seeing on Twitter. King 5 News didn't correct the article. So what I put out over the weekend on Twitter was basically meant to be a call to action for King 5 News to do something. I said, King 5 Seattle has known for at least 7 days that this article on the impacts of gender-affirming care is false, yet they have not removed or corrected it. I mean, I would suggest just removing it so no parents stumble upon it and just say, oh, this is what the study found, when it didn't. And I ended by saying, ask yourself why. And I think if you're being truthful with yourself, the reason is because they want the study to be accurate. They don't want to have to give in to pressure from like conservatives to correct a story about trans teens, gender identity, etc. But one of the reasons why I said I think it's particularly important that King 5 News do so, they have their actual saying, their slogan for their news station is, we stand for truth. They do these commercials, we stand for truth. Do you, though? Do you stand for truth? You know, truth can be inconvenient. It can make us angry. You know, the truth isn't always going to be what we hope it is. The truth isn't always going to align with our worldview. But we just have to accept that. And particularly as journalists, you have to accept that you're not always going to like the truth. But it's your job to find the truth anyway. So when you have a news entity that says, we stand for truth, yet when confronted with the truth, they will not relent, you seriously have to ask yourself, if you're on the right or the left, is that a news agency I can trust? Even if I want desperately for the study to show that rates of depression plummeted in trans teens who took gender-affirming care, if that's not what the study actually shows, I want my news agencies at least to say that. I want my news agencies at least to correct the record. And if King 5 News stands for truth, there should have been no delay, no hesitancy to correct the record. And it is deeply concerning to me that they, at least at the time that we're recording this, have not. I don't know if that's going to change. I don't know if it really matters at this point, frankly, because they had an entire week to decide to do the right thing, to live up to their slogan, we stand for truth, and they failed to do so. That's it for this episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you have not become a subscriber already, do so, and then you can join us every Wednesday for our bonus episodes, patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.